Welcome to Marfa Monday's podcast number 17, an interview with historian Lon Taylor, recorded in Fort Davis in March 2015. Hi, I'm your host, CM Mayo. Marfa Mondays explores Marfa, Texas, and the greater Big Bend region of Far West or Trans-Pecos, Texas. This series of 24 podcasts is apropos of my book in progress, World Waiting for a Dream, A Turn in Far West Texas. Right now, spring 2015, I'm wrestling with the draft, but if you're listening sometime in the future, this book may have already been published. So I invite you to visit my webpage, cmmayo.com, to find out all about it. And, by the way, listen in to all the other Marfa Mondays podcasts and find out about my several other books, the most recent of which are Metaphysical Odyssey into the Mexican Revolution, Francisco I. Madero, and his secret book, Spiritist Manual, and a novel based on the true story of 19th century Mexico, the last prince of the Mexican Empire. By those titles, you probably can guess, I love history. For anyone in any way interested in the Big Bend, historian Lon Taylor's column for the Big Bend Sentinel, The Rambling Boy, is both delightful and essential reading. You can find The Rambling Boy online at bigbendnow.com, and some of these columns have been collected in Texas My Texas, Musings of the Rambling Boy, and Texas People, Texas Places, More Musings of the Rambling Boy. Both those titles are available from TCU Press. Lon Taylor retired to Fort Davis with his wife Dee Dee after 20 years as a historian at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C. He received a B.A. in History and Government from Texas Christian University in 1961 and did graduate work at New York University before returning to Texas to enter the museum field. He's the author or co-author of several other books, including Texas Furniture, The Cabinet Makers and Their Work, The American Cowboy, New Mexican Furniture, and The Star-Spangled Banner. What brought you to the Big Bend in Fort Davis?
Well, I first came out here when I was 16. We were living in Fort Worth, which is what I consider my hometown. And my father was a highway engineer for the U.S. Bureau of Public Roads. And he had to come out here to inspect a highway job. I think it was probably U.S. 90. And this was in 1956. And it was summertime, and Dad liked to take me on trips with him in the summers. And so I rode out here with him. And we spent about 4 days here. We stayed in Alpine. We stayed here in Fort Davis. As a matter of fact, we stayed in a motel in Fort Davis that was in the officers' quarters at the fort. It was run by an old gentleman named Bish Tweedy, who had been made the caretaker of the fort by the Historical Society, which was leasing the fort. And he had turned the first four officers' quarters into motel rooms to help pay for the upkeep of the fort. But that was my first visit out here, and I had never seen a volcanic landscape like this. It just made an enormous impression on me. But I especially remember Mitre Peak, which was the only mountain I'd ever seen that was actually shaped like a mountain. You know, it just
like a big triangle
went up to a peak. Exactly. And so I remembered this many, many years. I never came back to the Big Bend until, I guess the mid-1960s, I made a trip out here with some other college friends. So then fast forward about 45 years, and in 1993, I had to come to Alpine on Smithsonian business. We were talking about producing some kind of cowboy poetry program at the Smithsonian, and so I got sent around to look at cowboy poetry gatherings, and there was one at Sol Ross, and so I came out to that. And it was real early spring, it was in February, but everything was green and creeks were flowing, and it was just absolutely beautiful. And so, going back to Midland to the airport on Sunday morning, I stopped here in Fort Davis in the drugstore and called Dee Dee on the phone, my wife in Washington, and said, Dee Dee, just sell the apartment, quit your job, get out here. This is the place. And at that time, we were a few years away from retirement, but we were thinking about it, you know. So when I got back to D.C., Dee Dee said, I want to see this place that you like so much. And so the next year, we took a three-week vacation in the Big Bend. And we went everywhere. We stayed at the Gage Hotel in Marathon. We stayed in the Chisos Basin. We stayed in here in Fort Davis. We stayed in Marfa. We even stayed in Presidio, and we just had an absolutely wonderful time. And of all the places that we visited, we liked Fort Davis the best because of its size and its topography and this mountain right here in the middle of town.
We're looking out.
That's called a mountain.
Yeah, we're looking out the window at
Sleeping Lion Mountain. And if you look at it from the north, it does look like a mountain lion with its paws out in front of it and its head down on its paws. So we loved it. And so we decided that if we really wanted to consider retiring here, that we ought to come back the next year and just spend 2 weeks here in Fort Davis and kind of try to figure out the rhythm of the town and what it was like. So I had a friend named Larry Francell, who I knew through the museum world. He was the assistant director of the Museum of Fine Arts in Dallas. And his wife came from an old Fort Davis ranching family. And I mentioned to Larry what we were thinking about doing, and he said, well, Beth and I will come out and spend a week with you and show you around. So the next year, we came out, and we rented a room at the Olympia Hotel for 2 weeks. And Larry and Beth came out, and they took us around and introduced us to all of Beth's family. They're the Millers, and they're an old ranching family. They took us down to Beth's great-uncle, I guess, Clay Miller, has about a 60,000-acre ranch south of Valentine. And we spent a day down there, and another uncle, Kimball Miller, is the real estate man I mentioned earlier. But I think there were two things that, well, there were three things, really, that decided us that this was the place we wanted to be. Clay Miller and his wife live on this very isolated ranch, and they had a huge library. And clearly loved books and loved literature and were extremely fine conversationalists. We just had a wonderful time with them. And I thought, you know, if this is your average Big Bend rancher, they're all fine people. Well, of course, it turned out that Clay wasn't average at all, but he is a wonderful man. And we enjoyed our visit with him immensely. And I always take visitors down there when people come from the north who want to know what ranching is all about. The second thing was the public library, which at that time was in the old jail. And they had an English literature cell, and they had a Southwestern literature cell, and an American literature cell. And each cell had bookcases in it, and a big easy chair, and a reading lamp. And I thought, you know, It's nice and cool in here in the summertime. I could just see myself sitting in one of these chairs and reading all day. And they had one of my books in the Southwestern collection, so I figured that was all right. And then the third thing was that Larry took us to the newspaper office to meet the editor. And the newspaper office is a little kind of one-room shack just off the town square. It's a little wooden building, Jeff Davis County Mountain Dispatch. And it's a one-person paper, you know. It's put out by one man who does everything. And so we went over there over the period of a week. We went over there three times to see him, and the door was wide open. There was nobody there. There was $300,000 worth of computer equipment lying around. And in Washington, we lived in an apartment building in a very nice part of town, and Dee Dee and I were both on the garden committee. And if we were working in the flower beds on Connecticut Avenue and went in to get a drink of water and left a trowel lying there, it was gone when we came back. And I thought, this is a throwback to the 1940s. It was wonderful. So when we finally retired, this is where we ended up. And we really never looked back. We'd love it.
What year did you come here?
We moved here in 2002. Dee Dee and I both retired on the same day. She was working for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and I was working for the Smithsonian. And we picked the same day to retire and loaded up a moving van and got in our car and headed west. We've been here ever since.
But you get out a lot to do your column.
Well, I drive around the Big Bend a lot, and we travel a good deal. We make a big trip nearly every year. Dee Dee has a sister who lives just outside of Oxford in England, and we go over there every 2 or 3 years and spend some time with her. And she comes here. She loves to come here.
And what do you do in Fort Davis? What is there to do besides the public library?
Well, I actually am working harder, I think, than when I got paid for working. I do a certain amount of museum consulting. I help people with exhibits and with museum planning and with historic houses. And I write a weekly column for the Marfa newspaper. And I write a monthly column for Texas Monthly magazine. And I've been working for some time on a memoir about my childhood in the Philippine Islands, and I need to finish that while I can still remember anything. I volunteer at the fort. The Fort Davis is a national historic site run by the National Park Service. When I first moved here, I served on the board of the Center for Big Bend Studies at Soil Ross. Dee Dee was on the school board for the past 2 years. I mean, there's an enormous amount of volunteer work that can be done here. You know, it's a small town. There are 1,160 people here. I've never understood how they calculated that, because it's an unincorporated town. It has no city limits. But somehow the census people have determined that that's the number of people that live here. And since we don't have any city government, nearly everything is done by volunteers.
There's no city government.
No.
There's no mayor.
No. Our public services are provided by the county. The county maintains the city streets. The sheriff maintains law and order.
It's that small.
Yeah, it's a county seat.
And do you go out much to the observatory?
We go to the observatory occasionally. Neither one of us are big amateur astronomers. I mean, we like to look at the stars, but we don't particularly care what their names are.
I think that would be a draw, this area, for some people.
Well, that is a big draw.
Yeah.
There are a lot of amateur astronomers who live here. There's a subdivision between here and the observatory called Olympia Crossing. Mm-hmm. And someone told me one time that there were something like 40 amateur astronomers who maintained telescopes out there. In fact, the largest privately owned telescope in the world is at Olympia Crossing.
Well, the stars here are so bright.
The stars. That was a big attraction. If you look at one of these satellite maps of the United States at night,
yeah,
the East Coast is a solid band of light. And then there's this big black hole out here in West Texas.
Yeah.
It's the darkest place in North America. That's probably not true. It's the darkest place in the United States.
How do you see this area as really different from the rest of Texas?
Well, you know, Texas is as big as France, bigger than France. And it's an extremely diverse place, geographically and ethnically and in every way. So every place in Texas is different from someplace else in Texas. But I think what makes the Big Bend unique is that for many, many years was the most isolated part of Texas. There were two east-west railroads that ran through here. But there were not a whole lot of people that lived out here because the land is very inhospitable. You really can't farm on it. People think they can raise cattle out here, and some people do, but it takes about 100 acres of land to support one cow and her calf, which is why some of these ranches are 200,000 to 300,000 acres. It was the last part of Texas to be settled. The population didn't really begin to grow out here until the 1880s, when the railroads came. And as I said earlier, it's volcanic, and it's the only part of Texas that's volcanic.
Culturally, Texas, I was born in Texas, but mm-hmm. I'm not culturally Texan. I grew up in California, all of which is to say I'm a native Texan, but I don't really understand Texan culture. And it seems a mix of Western and Southern, and then things that are, like when I look at Marfa, it seems Californian to me.
It's very hard to generalize about any culture, as you know. I think that Texas is basically a southern state. It, Texas was the westward extension of the Cotton Kingdom. It was a slave state. It was a Confederate state. Now, my bias may be that my own family came here from the deep south to grow cotton, and they were slave owners, and they all fought in the Confederate Army. But that's a different part of Texas entirely. They settled down on the Gulf Coast, which is like Mississippi or Alabama. The cattle business did not really come to Texas until after the Civil War. And most of the ranchers out here came, of their ancestors came, from South Texas and drove herds out here in the 1880s. And so I think they were largely Southern in their attitudes. And some of those attitudes are unfortunate. You know, there's a racist attitude towards both African Americans and Mexicans.
You've written about that in some of your columns.
Yeah. And it's regrettable, but it also, I think, marks Texas as a southern state rather than a state like Colorado or Montana or Wyoming. Or I think that one characteristic maybe of all Texans, and it may be the only characteristic that unites all Texans, is a fiercely independent attitude. Texans don't like people telling them what to do. As the psalm says, they hate correction and instruction. And the ranchers that came out here in the 1880s, I think, came largely to get away from civilization and people who were telling them what to do. And I think that's one reason that the ranching culture and the art culture blend so well in places like Marfa, because the old-timers here admire independence and independent thinking. And the young people who are flocking to Marfa are certainly independent and independent thinkers, and there's a good deal of mutual respect, I think.
That's an interesting point. Well, one thing I've noticed, and I don't know much about this, but if you buy a piece of land in a lot of places out here, I understand it's not subject to any kind of zoning. You can just build what
well,
you want on it.
That, I think, is an aspect of Texans not wanting people to tell them what to do. Texas does not have any state zoning legislation. Only municipalities have the power to pass zoning laws. Counties do not have zoning authority. And so there's no zoning at all in Jeff Davis County because there's only one incorporated municipality in Jeff Davis County, and that's the little town of Valentine, which has a population of 200. Marfa has zoning ordinances, but the rest of Presidio County is totally unzoned.
Yeah, I was asking someone out there the other day, well, could you build this and such out here? And he said, oh, you could put a 7-story building.
Oh, yeah.
I thought,
yeah.
Well, I can't imagine anybody would.
Well, you know, it's a delicate situation because we love Fort Davis just the way it is. And you just kind of have to trust your neighbors to have good sense and respect for their surroundings. On the other hand, it's kind of attractive to think that if we ever had a financial crisis, we could build a Tasty Freeze right there and supplement our income by selling snow cones or something.
You could just put whatever you want
yeah,
right there.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's wild.
Exactly.
Well, that's the Wild West. Well, your columns, I was going through them trying to think, how could I group them together and to think of how to ask you about them, but they're all over. Every column's a surprise.
Well, you know, I guess I think of myself as writing at least three different categories of columns. My favorites are the ones where I talk to somebody who's really interesting and write about them, and that involves a lot of work because you got to call somebody up, you got to make a date with them, you got to go see them, and occasionally there'll be a total dud. You know, you'll start asking people questions and they answer in monosyllables. But most of my interviews have resulted in pretty good stories. I think my favorite person-to-person column is the one about Bill Dodson.
The Candillero.
Exactly.
Candillero.
Exactly. You know, when you write a 1,000-word column, you want a snappy ending. And he gave me, I think, the best ending I've ever had for a column. He said, he's a 70-some-odd-year-old Anglo.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, there are a lot of ranchers out here that will tell you that they made wax. And they're not telling the truth. They watched Mexicans make wax. He said, I am the only Anglo who ever made wax out here, and I'll tell you I did not volunteer. Because he was a child when he was doing it, and he was child labor for his stepfather.
Speaking of lines, though, the opening of that piece, and the opening of many of these columns, the opening of that piece is, the other day I sat at a kitchen table in Alpine and talked with a man not much older than I am who grew up in the 19th century.
You like that?
I love it.
I like that, yeah.
I loved it.
Well, thank you.
But what brutal work. That was such a big part of the economy out here for many decades. But it's horrible. I mean, heat, boiling, all that.
Oh, yeah.
Candelia.
Tromping around in boiling sulfuric acid in a pair of sneakers was no fun.
No, and just harvesting the plants and the weather out here.
Oh, yeah.
Just nasty.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not easy walking around out in the Big Bend.
No, it's not. Then the second kind of column, if I can't find anybody interesting to interview, I kind of fall back on stories about my own family. or people I knew as a child. And I think of that category, my favorite, and the one that seems to be a favorite when I do readings, is the one about my grandmother, who grew up on a cotton farm and, among other peculiarities, was convinced that electric appliances had malign characteristics. Among other things, she thought that your watch would stop if you got on an electric streetcar. And my father, she lived with us most of the time I was growing up, and when we lived in Washington right at the end of the war, she would go blocks out of her way to avoid getting on a streetcar and take a bus instead. And my father would point out that he took a streetcar to work and back every day, and that it didn't affect his wristwatch. And she would say, "Well, my brother Will got on an electric streetcar in Austin in 1891, and as soon as he sat down, his watch stopped, and that is it." And then, if I get really stuck, because I've got a weekly deadline, you know, I'll write something about Texas history, because I've got a big library here. And there are a lot of good Texas history stories. You know, Texas history is taught in the 7th grade in Texas. It's a required 7th grade course. And then it's taught again in high school, I think in the junior year. And what is taught in classrooms is really a series of sort of cardboard cutouts that were devised in the late 19th century to teach little Anglo children to be proud of being Anglos. And I try to show how complex Texas was in the 19th century, a place with all kinds of people. Of course, there was a very large Spanish-speaking population. There was a large German population, Czech immigrants. There was a huge African-American population that just completely gets dropped out of standard history, or at least the history that people my age learned. I try to tell stories that reveal that complexity.
The Henry O. Flipper story.
Yeah, Henry O. Flipper is a good example. And there's a lot of misinformation about Henry O. Flipper. I mean, Henry O. Flipper deserved to be dismissed from the Army. He wrote a hot check and he lied to his commanding officer. It was not racism that caused Flipper to be dismissed from the Army. But the amazing thing to me about Flipper is that he then went on and built a very reputable career for himself as a mining engineer and a expert on Spanish land-grant documents.
Your column was The Epic of Henry O. Flipper, and he was the first African-American graduate of West Point, and he was posted here to Fort Davis.
That's right.
And then he had some trouble with the money.
Exactly.
And he came up short.
Well, the Army had a peculiar system. They didn't have any finance corps in the Army back then, as they do now. And so officers were assigned financial responsibilities that they were not necessarily qualified for. And Flipper was assigned to be the quartermaster officer, which meant that he was in charge of purchasing supplies for the fort, and he handled a lot of money. The thing that has never been explained is that there was a quartermaster safe in the quartermaster office, but Flipper chose to keep all the cash in his own quarters in a trunk. And he was a very popular young officer, not only with other officers, but with the townspeople here in Fort Davis. And he had people in and out of his quarters all the time. People would come over there and visit. They'd sit up and drink until all hours. And so he came up short about, I think, $2,000, which was a lot of money in the 1880s. And he had to file a monthly financial report with the commanding officer. And rather than just going to the commanding officer and saying he was short, he falsified those reports for 2 or 3 months, thinking, I'm sure, that he would find some way to get the money and make everything even. But his commanding officer, who was Colonel Benjamin Grierson, asked him point blank if he had sent the money to the bank in San Antonio. And he said yes, he'd sent it all to the bank, which he hadn't. I'm misspeaking a little bit. It wasn't a bank. It was the Army headquarters at Fort Sam Houston that he had to send the money to. And the headquarters at Fort Sam Houston reported to Grierson that the money had not arrived. And Grierson at first thought that there had been a stage robbery, which were frequent out here then. But he found out that wasn't the case. And so the jaws of the military justice system began to close around Flipper. And he then wrote a check on a bank that he did not have an account in. You know, at that time you could get what they called counter checks, and you wrote out the amount, and then you wrote the name of the bank in, and tried to make up the money that way. And, of course, the check bounced because he didn't have an account in that bank. And so he was court-martialed and charged with both conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman, and embezzlement. And he was acquitted on the embezzlement charge because it could not be proved that he had taken the money and used it himself. But he was convicted of conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman because he'd lied to his commanding officer and written a hot check.
But then Bill Clinton, President Clinton, pardoned him in 1999, many years after his death.
He did, and that was due largely to pressure brought by Flipper descendants and various black activists.
And why did they feel that Henry O. Flipper had done that, had misrepresented his commanding officer?
I think he was afraid. He was very young.
How old was he?
Oh, he was in his 20s. Uh-huh. You know, he was just out of West Point.
It seems to have an epic quality to it, as you said in your column.
But there are absolutely no racism involved, and most of the people who have written about Flipper, it turns out, have never read the court-martial documents. I do think it's an epic because of his redemption. And the odd thing is that he himself, when he got to be an old man, he wrote a memoir and claimed that racism had forced him out of the Army. He began to think that way himself. He actually became kind of obsessed with his Army problem, and he applied for pardons, I think, 7 or 8 times. And they were all rejected.
And what did he say had happened to the money?
He never said. The general theory among historians who've looked into it is that somebody who was visiting in his quarters took the money out of the trunk.
But he never had any idea who it would have been.
No.
I wonder if he wasn't protecting somebody.
Well, could be. Who knows? He had a servant, of course, as all officers did, and it may have been some enlisted man that took the money.
Some of the other columns you've done are really interesting in the regard of bringing up some of the secret historians, for example. You have a couple of really interesting columns about the secret historians, which is to say the people writing about the Hispanics who came to the region, because this region wasn't really populated until people started moving in at the same time, both Anglos and Mexicans.
Well, there was a very mysterious man named Victoriano Hernandez, who had a ranch down on Alamito Creek, about halfway between Marfa and the Rio Grande. And he was evidently there in the late 1850s or early 60s. And on the 1870 or 1880 census, he is among the 5 wealthiest men in Presidio County. His occupation is given as ranchero, and he evidently had a lot of vaqueros working for him and a lot of cattle.
But he wasn't recognized with a marker or his
house. No.
Yeah.
I'm actually going down to interview his great-great-grandson sometime in the next couple of weeks.
Who still lives there?
Well, he lives at Casa Piedra.
Oh.
But the Hernandez house is still standing. And oddly enough, it belongs now to a family named Russell, who are Hispanics. They're descendants of Victoriano Hernandez. But there was a very early Anglo settler here named Russell,
uh-huh,
who married a Mexican woman, as did all the early Anglo settlers here. I always tell people that the oldest Hispanic families in Fort Davis are named Hartnett, Webster, and Dutchover.
I'm laughing because that reminds me so much of Baja California, where some of the old families are named Davis and Green.
Yeah, all descended from
Smith.
English.
From
sailors, yeah.
But the family's Mexican and they've been there forever.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're Smith.
Yeah.
Armando Vasquez, whose book is I Well Remember.
Oh, yeah.
I love that book.
Oh, Armando's just wonderful.
I tried to interview him last time I was here and he had the flu.
Oh.
I hope to get him next time I'm here. I loved his book and I drove by that. I wasn't able to go in because, of course, it was closed, but the museum he keeps. On Casa Piedra Road.
Yeah.
I saw that from the highway, La Plata.
Yeah. Well, Armando's related to the Russells.
And another one was Juan Manuel Casas, who wrote Federico
Fiaba. He claims that the family traces their ancestry back to Romans who lived at a place called Villa Alba. Point Villa, in other words, in Latin.
The other one I thought was really interesting that you wrote about in your column was Tony Cano's Marfa.
Oh, yeah.
He wrote the biography of his great-grandfather, Chico Cano, who was a famous bandleader.
Yeah, and I've never been able to get a copy of that.
Oh, I have a copy.
Have you got a copy?
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting to compare Armando's autobiography and Tony Cano's novel.
The Other Side of the Tracks?
It's a fictionalized account of his own growing up.
In Marfa in the
Marfa.
50s, when it was
segregated. And I've talked to him on the phone. I've never met him. But he is still very bitter about the racism that he encountered. He is a little bit younger than Armando.
Mm-hmm.
But Armando does not have a bad word to say about anybody.
Mm.
And I'm inclined to think that a lot of perceived racism has to do with your own personality, you know? Now, admittedly, Armando grew up out in the country where he really did not have any childhood experiences with racism. I think he told me that he came to Marfa after the war, after he got out of the army.
Mm.
And he was refused service in a barber shop in Marfa. But the guy said, oh, no, you need to go to the Mexican barber. And so Armando said, oh, okay, I'll go to the Mexican barber. And that he didn't make a big deal out of it, you know, that was it.
Well, you know, a lot of people younger than myself don't even know about segregation. And when they first hear about it, they're shocked. But it ended in 1964, isn't that right?
There was never legal segregation in Marfa. Meaning segregation of Mexican Americans. So there's no real ending date. There was customary segregation. There were two grade schools, a Mexican school and an Anglo school. There was only one high school because it was never assumed that a Mexican would go to high school in Marfa. And Tony Cano's book is about being among the first Mexicans who went to the Anglo high school. But the movie theaters were segregated in that Anglo set in the center and Mexican set on each side.
And when did that end?
Well, it's hard to say. I actually could not give you a date. Sometime in the 1960s. Now, segregation between whites and blacks in Texas, of course, ended theoretically in 1954 with Brown versus the Board in schools, and then in 1965 with the passage of the Civil Rights Act. But I went to a segregated high school in Texas in 1957. I went to a segregated Christian college and graduated in 1961. So there was a lot of foot dragging.
Albert Alvarez, secret historian.
Oh, Albert is just, you need to go talk to him.
That's my favorite column.
Yeah, he is a wonderful man.
He's in Pecos.
He's in Pecos.
He writes Recuerdos de mi Pueblo for the local.
Well, paper. He did, yeah. I don't think he's doing it anymore. I'm not sure there is a local Pecos paper anymore.
And he's got them all gathered together,
yeah.
And they haven't been published as a
no,
book.
They're all on yellow legal pads.
Oh, my God. I hope those are saved.
He told me that some big Eastern University library that was trying to build up a Chicano history collection called him and said, can you send me your discs? And he said, what do you mean discs? He'd never heard of computer discs. You know, he said, it's all yellow legal pads. And he showed me he's got 2 or 3 foot lockers in his study. And opened them up, they were just full of legal pads with pencil writing on them.
This is the kind of thing that just makes me feel like I can't breathe. I don't know what's the word. It's like when you look at history, from my own projects, I have stories like this, and I'm sure you've seen many more than I have, where you realize it's like this little bottleneck, and if that is lost, this whole world is lost.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Albert is just, his images were so vivid when I talked to him. He talked about these trucks going through the Mexican section of Pecos to pick up the cotton pickers early in the morning and people calling to each other from the back of the truck, you know, saying, get up, you lazy bastards. A voice would come out of the house saying, no, I'm not working today.
You also wrote about the two Garcias.
Yeah.
Dr. Hector P. Garcia of Corpus Christi, who founded the GI Forum, and then Gustavo Garcia.
I never met either one of them, but I certainly heard a lot of stories about Gus Garcia, because I knew people in San Antonio who had known him.
Huge figures in Mexican-American history.
Oh, yeah.
And yet they ended up very differently.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, there's so many I could comment on. I mean, I love the one you did on Colonel Crimmins, the rattlesnake venom man.
Yeah. He became a volunteer curator at the Whitty Museum.
In San Antonio.
I think he lived to be nearly 90.
He came up with the venom for rattlesnakes.
Yeah.
From his own blood.
Yeah.
But when he did his rattlesnake venom, that was out in El Paso, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think he was at Fort Bliss.
And you also wrote, I'm still coming back to the secret historians here. You wrote about the Ronquillo Grant.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, the Ronquillo Grant's one of my favorite Big Ben stories.
That's a telenovela. That's a soap opera.
You know, the one thing that I never was able to find out is if the Chicago speculator, whose name has now escaped me, Dale, wasn't it?
I don't remember.
I never was able to find out if he actually paid the several million dollars for the grant.
There was this wild thing cooked up by a Mexican army captain back when it was just the Apacheria.
Well,
where nobody could actually use the land.
You know, there was so much land fraud here in the early days. And that fellow, Leighton, was a master at it. He was a very sleazy character.
And this is Ben Leighton of Fort Leighton.
Yeah.
He was a trader.
Yeah.
Right on the Rio Grande.
Well, he built that fort where the Chihuahua Trail crossed the Rio Grande. And, you know, like everything, there's conflicting evidence about him. The army hated him. The army records say that that place was a nest of thieves and all sorts of stuff went on there that was illegal. The Mexican governor of Coahuila said the same thing. But various travelers who stopped there and knew him only as a very genial and hospitable host, and they wrote good things about him.
Well, that was the time when the Comanches were, and Apaches were robbing cattle in Mexico.
Oh, yeah.
And then bringing it back to sell.
Exactly.
And Victor Ochoa got involved in the Ronquillo Grant. He's another character from the time of the Revolution.
Yeah. Aviation. He's an interesting guy, isn't he?
Yeah. And his papers are at the Smithsonian.
Yeah. He had a granddaughter who placed them at the Museum of American History.
Well, coming back to your columns, you have a lot of columns about Marfa. And I love that you also, when you interviewed, say, Adam Bork and Krista Steinhauer of the Food Chart. Which is really good, by the way.
It is. Food Chart.
The Food Chart. That's a Marfa institution.
Yeah. I always think of it as a regimental mess, because you can see anybody you want to see at Marfa if you just go to the Food Chart at noon. Well, now, do you know about the Filipino restaurant in Marfa?
No.
You know where the Capri is? Well, the Capri is that big kind of event space that's catacornered from the Thunderbird. It's usually empty, you know, it's a place for dances and wedding receptions. But in the past few months, Jenny Leberman and her new husband, they have started a restaurant in the building behind the Capri, which is part of the Capri complex. And they have leased it 2 days a week to a Filipina chef who has assembled a whole kitchen full of Filipinos from Presidio. And they're preparing the food of my childhood. It's absolutely wonderful. You can go in there. Pancit is a rice noodle that's served with vegetables and little cubes of pork, and it's absolutely delicious. And you can get pancit in there on Sundays and Mondays. And then they take Tuesdays off, and then from Wednesday through Saturday, it's leased to another chef who serves fried chicken and kind of southern comfort food.
I had heard about the Filipinos in Presidio a while ago.
Yeah, I've got to get down there and do a column on that.
I would love to read that column.
Yeah.
Well, I had understood that they had come as school teachers.
They did. The school district began recruiting Filipinos.
And they won a prize.
Well, science teaching, a national science teaching prize. And then they were trying to deport her. There was some irregularity in her papers, and Pete Gallego got it fixed.
He was the congressman.
He was a congressman from here.
Well, in writing all these columns that you've done, surely you've got a different impression now than you had before you came here?
Oh, yeah.
What did you learn?
Definitely.
What surprised you?
Boy, that's a very good question. Well, I learned that it was more complicated and more complex than I thought it was.
Well, I get that from your columns. You know, of how you'll go into these stories, like everything from the Food Sharp to Rube Evans and Polo.
Oh, yeah.
That now, surprised me.
Who would have ever
me.
Thought, you know, that they played Polo in the big band? That was something I knew nothing about.
Polo came to the U.S. through the military
through the
in
Army.
Far West Texas.
Exactly.
I never would have imagined that.
Exactly. Well, I knew they played Polo in San Antonio, and that they played it there because the Army was there. But it just never occurred to me that they would also be playing Polo at Fort Davis and Fort Bliss and Fort D.A. Russell in Marfa.
You talked about how they went down to play in Mexico City's Chapultepec Park back in, what, the 50s or something?
Well, it was when Alemán was president. That was in the
50s.
The Mexican Army used to come up to Fort D.A. Russell and play polo in the 1930s.
Well, who'd have thought? Coming back to your column, some of the ones that really surprised me are where you interview some really unexpected and unusual people. Like one was Rube Evans and Polo, and the other was the Propeller Man.
Yeah.
Ray Hagee.
Exactly.
H-E-G-Y.
H-E-G-Y.
The Propeller Man of Marfa.
I learned about him from Georgia Lee Cole. And if you haven't met Georgia Lee, you need to. Georgia Lee comes from an old ranching family here. Her grandfather was a man named Jones who owned five or six big ranches here. And Georgia Lee married a man named Fritz Kahl, who came here with the Army during World War II and was a pilot trainer, and met Georgia Lee during the war and stayed here the rest of his life and ran a charter airplane service. And so Georgia Lee started telling me one night about this man who made propellers. And I said, I never heard of anybody making propellers. I didn't know that's the way they were made.
Yeah, he made them by hand?
Yeah, he made them by hand. So I said, can I go interview this guy? George Lee said, well, he died about 4 years ago, but his house is still vacant. And he made the propellers in a shop behind his house. And I can take you over there. So we got in my car, and it was only a couple of blocks from her house. And here's this little frame house with the yard all grown up, you know, and clearly vacant. And I started to park by the curb, and Georgia Lee says, I think if you pull into the driveway, nobody can see our car. And I said, oh, okay. And so we pulled into the driveway. She said, keep going back. And we got back behind the house, and here was this little frame shop where he did his work. And George Lee said, let's go see what we can see through the window. And so we got out of the car and went and peered through the window. And George Lee went over to the door, and she says, I think if you just push on this door, it'll open. To me, you know, she wasn't going to do it herself. So I pushed on the door, and sure enough, we walked into the shop. And all his tools were still there. There were propellers leaning up against the wall. At his workbench, there was a huge metal clip that had all his work orders on it. And George Lee says, I think these belong in the museum. And she reached up and pulled them out of the clip and put them in her purse. And she's 80-something. I didn't want to touch anything, you know. So I made a bunch of notes, and we left. And ever after that, every time I see Georgia Lee, she says, you got any more houses we could go break into?
It's a wonderful piece. And at the end, you really explain why this is really important history for aviation.
Yeah.
And for the town.
I guess I like discovering and writing about the unexpected. Everybody kind of has a stereotype of Marfa, either as the cattle town where they filmed Giant, or a contemporary art center.
Mm-hmm.
And I like discovering things that don't fit into that stereotype.
There are two others that really I should have, when we were talking about the secret history, I should have brought up that I thought were so extraordinary. You wrote a piece called Lee Bennett and Marfa's History. She was a high school teacher.
Oh, yeah.
And she organized the junior historian chapter in Marfa in 1966 and got the kids to do oral history.
Exactly.
With their parents and grandparents. And so these are really the only records of the history of Hispanic Marfa.
That is where most of it is. I think there are also the Catholic Church has records that I haven't been able to get into. One of the things I've learned from that, Marfa did not have a large Hispanic population until the Mexican Revolution. Of course, there is no 1880 census of Marfa because the town wasn't organized. There's no 1890 census because the 1890 census records were all burned. But the 1900 census shows about a 10% Hispanic population, if you just count everybody that's got a Spanish last name. But the 1920 census, it shoots up to like 60%. And this was the result of refugees coming across the border. You know about the Battle of Ojinaga?
Yeah.
The 5,000 civilian refugees.
They walked from Presidio to Marfa, and they had to figure out how to feed them and take care of them. It was a...
And a lot of those people just kind of melted into Marfa. But there were others that just came on their own. And there are a lot of stories in those junior historians papers, you know, about people's grandfathers loading up a buggy and a wagon in Ojinaga or Monterey or Chihuahua City or someplace and just heading north.
Well, you must have a lot of columns ready to go, or do you come up with them at the last
minute? Well, I try to stay a couple of weeks ahead, but I'm right down to the wire. I've never missed a deadline, and I've now written, I think I'm on about number 680 something.
No all-nighters to finish.
I can't write at night. I start about 4 a.m., and I'm pooped out by noon.
You're always up that early.
Yeah, I've gotten up that early all my life. Well, you know, I grew up in the Philippines, and the sun comes up there at 5 a.m., and as I said, my grandmother lived with us, and she was an old farm girl, and she got up about 4, and she didn't believe our cook could make coffee, and so she would go back in the kitchen and make herself a pot of coffee, and she would wake me up going past my bedroom door, and I would get up and join her, and I've just done that all the rest of my life.
So you were born in the Philippines?
No, I was born in South Carolina.
And then you went to the Philippines?
Oh, we went to the Philippines when I was 6.
That's small. And you were there until?
Until I was 15.
That's a really formative time to be
yeah.
there. Where were you in the Philippines?
In Manila.
Have you been back since?
I've never been back. And I don't really want to go back.
I bet it's really different now.
Oh, it's... I've kept up with a lot of my classmates, and they say that Manila is just awful. The air pollution is horrible. Traffic is horrible. The peace and order situation is so bad you're liable to get kidnapped if you get in a taxi cab.
Well, when you were there, it was more like a small town?
It was a big city, but it wasn't as big as it is now. There weren't as many automobiles. They still had horse-drawn... They call them calesas, little two-wheel gigs. There were some streets that were so narrow you couldn't get an automobile into them.
Wow. Do you have a title for your book, your memoir about growing up?
Well, the first line of the Philippine National Anthem is Child of the Morning.
That's a good title.
Yeah, so I thought that was a pretty good title.
What years were you there then?
From 1946 to 1955.
46?
Yeah.
It was right after the war.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole city was in ruins. Most of my classmates were kids who'd been interned in Santo Tomas internment camp by the Japanese. There's a woman named Mary Bright who was a year behind me, actually. But her father was a Viennese Jew who was a chemist. And he had gotten out right after Anschluss, he and his wife. And his wife was a college graduate of some kind. And they came to Manila, and he was employed by an American chemical company. So when the war started, that company evacuated all their American citizen employees, but left his and his wife behind, and the company closed down. So they didn't have any income. And Mary said, my father was a very smart man, and he figured out that even if there was a war on, people had to take baths. And he set up a soap factory in their home and made soap out of copra, which is the shell of a coconut, which was plentiful in the Philippines. But then he had the problem of, how am I going to market my soap? And his wife, who was this high-born Viennese woman, walked to the market every day and sold soap on the sidewalk. You know, and this is a woman who'd had servants all of her life.
How extraordinary.
Yeah. So one thing that growing up that way taught me was that people are infinitely resilient. You know, people can adopt to almost anything. It was a good lesson to learn. Young person. The downside was that until I was in my 30s, I thought it was perfectly all right to hate all Japanese. because people in the Philippines were very, very bitter about the Japanese occupation. Not just Americans who lived through it, but Filipinos themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I've struggled and struggled to overcome. At one time I thought, when I was in my 20s, I thought I would take a trip to Japan and visit national parks, because Japan had a fabulous national park system. And I thought any country that could produce beautiful national parks can't be all bad, but I never did it.
I just can't imagine coming to the Philippines in 1946.
What I remember most vividly was that the whole city was in ruins. I have a photograph that was made the first night that we were in Manila. I was 6 years old. My father's office had arranged a big Bienvenido banquet, which had the Manila Hotel. My parents didn't know that they were going to do this. So there was nobody to look after me, and I got taken along to the banquet. So there's a photograph of all these people in jackets and ties sitting at a long table, and me at the end of the table, although the photographer put me there. And I'm wearing a coat and open-throated shirt and, you know, a little white suit, I think. And the wall behind the table is obviously canvas army shelter halves that are buttoned together. And when Didi first saw that picture, she said, "Well, that's an elegant-looking banquet, but why is that wall canvas?" And I said, "Because there was no wall there. It had been blasted away during the liberation, and it hadn't been repaired, and they just had canvas hanging there."
Well, that's what strikes me as so interesting about history, and that comes out for me in your columns and in what you said in answer to my question about what surprised you, is that it seems like we get these ideas from school. You know, like, these are the French people, these are the German people, this is Latin America, this is this, that's that, and it all seems very orderly. But when you put a microscope on it,
it's a lot more complicated.
Yeah, and it's sometimes extremely surreal.
Yeah. And I delight in that.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. Well, that might be a good place to end our interview. And I look forward to continuing to read your columns.
Well, great. Great. I've enjoyed this immensely.
Well, thank you. Thanks for listening. This has been podcast number 17 of a projected 24 podcasts. Listen in to all the podcasts anytime at cmmayo.com/Marfa. Until next time.